Hey everyone, just a heads up, this is part one of a two-part episode. Part two will come out in just 1 week, not two, on February 4th. Okay, here's the show. In 2003, Dan Bickley was living his best Alaskan outdoorsman life.
I was 25 at the time, very free-spirited in nature. I was very much into the outdoors, the wilderness, adventure, and really found a community that I fell into in Girdwood, Alaska. It's a beautiful mountain community nestled in the Chugach Mountains. It's just gorgeous.
Spending so much time in the outdoors over the course of his life, Dan had a good amount of knowledge about the dangers that exist in the wilderness.
Well, I'd had a lot of experience with bears, as well as I'd studied them academically. I mean, so definitely had a very healthy respect. My undergraduate degree was in, natural history and ecology. I had a lot of experience, sort of researching and understanding bear-human interactions and conflicts. And then obviously when you go to Alaska and you spend a lot of time outside, you're aware of it in more than just a cerebral way. You feel it in your body, this your place and in the food chain, and the bears are just pretty content doing their own thing as long as you respect them and give them space and stuff like that. But this encounter was very different right from the very beginning. We could tell she was super agitated.
This is Live to Tell, the podcast where I talk to some of the bravest people who have been through the most horrifying things and lived to tell the tale. I'm Caitlin Van Maul. On July 15th, 2003, Dan had spent a day fishing with his friend John and his dog Maya. They had actually wrapped up and were having dinner at a local burger place.
Heard the chatter that there were some fish coming in down at the confluence of the Russian Kenai Rivers. And I went down to the river, and it was pretty awesome. It was like one of those beautiful Alaskan summer days where, sun stays out late. That sort of pink sky twilight time sort of lasts forever or indefinitely, really, until the sun starts to come back up again. Fish were in. Had a good time. I should throw out there that my dog, Maya, she was quite a wonder dog.
What kind of dog was she?
She was a lab shepherd mix.
Oh.
She was one of those dogs that, we just went everywhere and did everything together and had developed such a rapport that one of the things I loved about fishing was my dog, Maya. And she would usually just kind of nestle up by wherever I put my backpack down. And then whenever we caught pulled a fish in, she'd come down to inspect,
See if it passes the test.
Yeah.
So after catching a few fish, John, Dan, and Maya decided to pack it up and head out. It was about 10 p.m.
It's about a 20-minute hike or so back up to the trailhead, and we pretty much made it all the way back. There's some stairs that go from the trail up to the trailhead, and we're pretty darn close to those stairs when, all of a sudden Maya lets out this little growl. Of course, natural instinct, I just look up to see what it is that she's tuned into. And sure enough, on the trail in front of us, 30 or so feet away was a large brown bear. It was obvious immediately that this bear was pretty agitated.
Yeah.
She was sort of huffing and puffing. Her hair kind of stood on end. She was, bouncing on her front paws a little bit. So my friend John and I, pretty calm at that point. I mean, alarmed that she seemed so agitated. But, we just kind of stand close together, put our arms up in the air to make ourselves look bigger. And we just kind of conferred for a minute or, 30 seconds or so.
Yeah.
To kind of develop our plan, what's our strategy here, and decided the best thing was just to kind of back away and head further upriver, give her as much space as she needed. We were going to take a longer route back around to a different trailhead to get back to our car. And so we did. And we were able to back away slowly with no, event, and then start heading up the trail. And we got to the point to where we kind of were able to relax, and we started to talk about like, wow, that was kind of a crazy encounter. When all of a sudden in front of us on the trail, we see the alders shaking pretty vigorously. So, you know, my first thought, I'm sure John's too, was like, okay, we're being cut off by the same bear. And that's not good behavior from a bear. You know, anytime they're following you, stalking you, not letting you kind of walk away, that's not a good situation to be in. I'd never been in that type of situation before.
Being stalked by a bear is definitely not a good situation. But that's not what was going on. What was actually happening was so much worse.
What I didn't know then, but what we know now, is that in the shaking bushes that were behind me were her cubs.
Mm.
We didn't realize there were cubs in the equation at all, but, you know, really put ourselves inadvertently in like the worst possible situation between an agitated bear and her cubs.
So, thinking the bear is what's shaking the alders, they turned around again and started back in the direction they were going before they saw the bear.
In no more than 10, 15 steps, the bear came ripping around the corner, and it just a flash was upon us. My dog, Maya, who was out kind of in the front of our group, you know, she leaps off the trail and towards the left, and the bear swiped at her, but didn't connect, you know. John, who was directly in front of me at this point, you know, he leaps off the trail into the alders. And it's kind of at this moment in time where, for me, time really slowed down. Like, it almost became very surreal very quickly, where, you know, we're trained as Alaskans to not run. We're trained to stand our ground when there's a bear charging you, because they oftentimes will do what's called a bluff charge. But I just remember this voice in my head that was like telling me that this is different, you know, like this is real. This is really happening. You need to do something. Things got real, and I leapt off the trail in the same direction Maya had. But before I'd even hit the ground, she had a hold of my leg. It was kind of pulling me back onto the trail.
A hold of your leg in her mouth or her claws?
She was pawing at me with her front claws and pulling me back out of the bushes. Yeah. So since I was in the back of the group and the closest to the shaking bushes, I think she was just on a beeline for me. And after she pulled me out of the bushes, I don't really, you know, it's all kind of a blur. I remember hearing the scream, and it sounded awful in like a dying animal sort of a way. And then I realized like that it was me making that noise. I was like, that was a little disconcerting. And then kind of in a blur, you know, everything's kind of happening kind of fast. I don't really know what happened, but next thing I knew, she had picked me up. Presumably, I must have been by her mouth. And it's not clear if it was by my head or, you know, my shoulder or my backpack or what. But then the next thing I knew, I was getting drug up into the woods. So I just felt trail and grass and roots and stuff going, you know, going by as I was getting drug off into the woods. Yeah, then I lost consciousness. Everything went black. And I would wake up, come back to consciousness, and, you know, recognize that the mauling was still continuing, that she was, you know, tearing up my leg pretty good, that there was a puncture in my back, my arms and shoulders were getting it pretty good, and I was face down, you know, which was good at this point. This kind of happened several times where I would lose consciousness and come back to consciousness, and in the mauling kind of continuing. But then one time when I came back to consciousness, I was not being mauled, and I heard my friend John call my name from a distance, and I knew I'd been drug off into the woods. I obviously had no idea like where or how far, and wanted him to know where I was. And so I called out to him. And unfortunately, to the bear, that was too much sign of life. And so she returned to me, and the mauling continued at that point. And then the next time I woke up from unconsciousness, something, I was aware right away that this was not good, because she had managed to get me flipped over. So I was now face up. And she was standing over the top of me with her front paws digging into either shoulder with her face directly over mine. And that's when she essentially like turned her head sideways and bit down across my face from side to side and then chewed. So there was a big pop. Everything went blue and black, and I was out cold, obviously. That's when things took a real weird turn, if in terms of my experience of it all. I had a real like dissociation, like a real dissociative experience. Essentially what happened for me was I woke up and immediately became aware that there was no more terror, or like the horror of it all seemed to be gone. It was almost peaceful and blissful. There was no physical pain. I didn't really know where I was or what was going on. So I'm kind of trying to figure that out. Kind of like a death dying experience where there was nothing but this kind of iridescent blue light. And that's all there was. There was no real shape or form or anything else. I think in that moment, you know, I realized that I was kind of at this crossroad where I could probably just let go of life, or I could try to like hold on to it.
But then
my mom, who was perfectly alive and well down in California at the time, all of a sudden, you know, she kind of, I see an image of her just kind of smiling and waving to me. And she looked radiant and happy, and you know, whatever that connection to her and to that in that moment made my decision that I was going to fight to hold on to life. And it was weird. It's weird to reflect back on, you know, kind of hard to imagine that I was in a position to be having these types of thoughts and reflections, but I kind of realized that probably the worst outcome would be that if I survived, would I look back and question that decision to hold on to life, or would I look back and or maybe even regret that decision? And recognizing that, you know, in my mind at that time, that was the worst possible outcome, I just made a commitment to myself to not allow myself to ever look back and second guess that decision. I mentioned that there was no shape or form, and, you know, that there's, just kind of like this blissfulness, this peacefulness to the place. Well, at one point I look over and I kind of see what appears to be like a silhouette shape of my grandfather, who was no longer with us at the time. He's sort of like onlooking, standing by, you know, but I feel like his presence and this support in, I think the prevailing feeling was like love. And that kind of grew in terms of the experience from there to, you know, the next thing I knew, there's a couple of my old college close friends that were present. And then it just kind of continued to grow. Got to the point to where it felt like everybody that had ever loved me and was connected to me was there in presence and in spirit and kind of looking on with support. And so it was powerful, which again, you know, if you think about this as a dissociative experience, like if this is just a biological or evolutionary ability of the brain to create these experiences during these life threatening situations, it's amazing.
It's almost like your brain is like, remember all this love and happiness and goodness, because you're about to experience a lot of shit.
It's the medicine, you know?
Yeah.
I need it. Even just to stay alive, probably, in that moment. Like, you can't stay in the horror and the terror of what was really happening to my body, right?
Yeah.
I felt like I was given permission to just rest and to stay there for a while. And so I just kind of laid there and stayed, you know, resting, conserving energy. And then it, you know, there came a point to where there was this acknowledgement and recognition that it was time for me to go back into my body. And the next thing I knew, I saw my body from overhead to start. I was looking down at myself, laying on the forest floor. And then I woke up inside my body and, you know, became aware again of my surroundings, hearing the wind in the trees and the river nearby. And, you know, it was clear right away that I wasn't being mauled anymore. Bear was gone.
We'll be right back. Now fully conscious, Dan started to assess the damage the bear had inflicted.
Right away, became aware that I had no control over my arms and legs, and I could feel blood pooling under my head. I could feel blood pooling in my waders, and I realized, like, I was in really bad shape.
Yeah.
that the only chance I had at survival at that point in time was to lay completely still and try to conserve energy just to stay, you know, hold on to life, just to stay alive and wait for rescue.
And rescue was coming, thanks to Maya, the wonder dog.
My dog, Maya, ran all the way back down to the confluence of the Russian River, which I said earlier was like about a 20-minute walk, right?
So yeah.
She ran all the way back down there, and there were some fishermen standing there who had seen us come through. And Maya, my dog Maya, at this time was barking herself, you know, barking, and her hair was raised on end. And they saw her and not us, and they saw kind of how panicked and alarmed she was.
Yeah.
And they were like, something's not right. And so they actually followed her up the trail to where they found my friend John. And then, fortunately, they had guns and a cell phone. And so they came to find me. I just remember hearing John's voice when he saw me, just like, Dan, you know.
Yeah.
And he immediately took off his shirt and started wrapping my head up to try to control the bleeding.
The man who had the cell phone went and searched for a signal to call 911.
And it would be about 2 hours or so before the volunteer EMS would arrive from Cooper Landing.
And what is going through your mind in those 2 hours? Just stay alive, stay alive, stay alive?
Well, I started to go out of it again some more after people were on the scene. You know, things kind of got blurry, you know, for me for a while. I remember different little individual parts of it. But for the most part, I was starting to check out. And, you know, I was told that, you know, there were some moments in there where, you know, I stopped breathing. I do remember, you know, when the EMTs got there and started working on me, and they obviously had to get me out of the forest and up that big flight of stairs that I was talking about that goes up to the trailhead. So they assembled a bunch of bystanders, essentially fishermen, to help carry me up the stairs.
EMTs loaded Dan into the ambulance, which drove him to a helicopter, which took him to the hospital.
As soon as I got to the ambulance, they started giving me medication that would make me forget everything.
Oh.
Yeah, and I don't know if that's like intentional, like in turn, or if that's like a side effect, right?
Yeah.
But essentially, as soon as they started, drugging me at the ambulance, my memory of things really goes blank.
Dan was kept in a medically induced coma for 12 days, and he would learn later that
the ER doctor's report said patient arrived at the hospital in a condition incompatible with human life, eyes, nose, forehead, anatomy unrecognizable.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. The main surgeon, there was obviously many of the doctors and surgeons, but the sort of main guy that was there from the very first night when I arrived at the ER tells a story, about after, I think it was like an 18-hour long surgery or something ridiculous. How he went back to his office and closed the door and cried. And it wasn't because he'd never seen, you know, severe facial trauma before or anything like that, but it was because, you know, here I was, this 25-year-old kid, kind of in the peak of his life, and exactly that, like, would he thank me for saving his life? Yeah. So basically, in the bear mauling, 6 out of 7 of the major arteries that carry blood to the scalp were either lacerated or totally severed. And so the blood supply to different parts of my head and my scalp was very compromised. There were some wounds, including, you know, the one that sort of sits on my forehead, kind of just above my nose and above my brows, kind of like right in the center of my forehead. There were wounds there that, you know, had been sutured multiple times, but they kept reopening. And some of that too, like just to put more context to this, I mean, during some of the reconstructive surgery that had already taken place up to that point in time, basically, where the bear had chewed, and when I described the incident, you know, the bear first bit across my face, but then chewed. And so what that did was, I mean, not only were the bones broken, every single bone in my face and head were broken, except for my mandible. That actually includes the palate that holds the brain up into its proper place. And so my brain had actually herniated down into my sinus cavity. And when before the reconstructive surgery, there was actually that whole time I was in the medically induced coma, my brain was exposed to the outer world.
Oh my.
Through the sinus cavity. It's kind of insane.
How do you live? What's that? Something compatible. I guess it's not compatible with life is what the lady said, but yikes.
Yeah, yikes is right. The dura, which is the sac that holds the brain and the cerebral spinal fluid, had been torn open in three places, meaning that the bear had literally been within millimeters of the brain. And so leaking cerebral spinal fluid for that entire time as well.
And that was just coming out your nose?
There wasn't really much of a nose left.
Okay.
Oh, so, yeah. It was just kind of coming out.
Coming out. Okay. Yeah.
Kind of about the wound. Yeah.
Coming out somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. Until they were really able to start to kind of move back together. I mean, when they said eyes, nose, forehead anatomy unrecognizable, I mean, they weren't, I wasn't really hyperbole. And so, but because all the bones that make up the structure of your face had not only been broken, but in some cases where the bear had chewed, crushed to a powder, like pulverized. Uh-huh. And so there just wasn't much to work with. So during those initial surgeries, they pieced together titanium mesh scaffolding and then put, you know, plates and screws and more titanium mesh scaffolding to essentially rebuild all of the facial structure and anatomy. So my eyebrows, my nose, my cheeks, like all of it is rebuilt with titanium mesh, even all the way up to the top part of my head and scalp had to be rebuilt with titanium.
Wow. So your skull is mostly metal.
Yeah. Yep.
While doctors were reforming Dan's skull, the drugs he was on to keep him in the coma were not quite restful.
I don't even know how to describe it other than like maybe like a psychedelic nightmare that never ends. And you don't know if it's day or night or if you're awake or asleep and what's real and what's not real. But it was as chaotic as any dream. But and sometimes there were moments of like more peaceful, calm oriented, or was this like being trapped in a nightmare where everything was chaos and fighting demons? I mean, it was weird. I was like, you know, I mean, I'll just give you an example.
Yeah.
I'm laying around in a field and I almost picture it like a World War II medic camp where there's like, you know, hundreds of animal attacked victims.
Oh, yeah.
Laying around in this field and there's nurses kind of coming around and tending to people. And then one of them comes up and she's got this huge needle and she's wanting to give me a shot. And for whatever reason, I didn't think it was good for me. And so I was trying to resist it and trying to, fight her off essentially. And,
yeah.
And interestingly, I would learn later that early on that they actually did have to restrain me in the hospital bed because
I was
fighting them. Right. But in my world, I was like in this nightmare sort of scenario, so far from reality.
After those 12 days, when Dan came out of sedation, his doctors needed to have a serious conversation with him about his condition.
Kind of the first interaction back in reality after the bear mauling is the doctors talking to me to, first of all, let me know that I was completely blind.
His doctors already had to fully remove one eye and wanted to talk to Dan before removing the other.
I'm still sort of like half in the dream state and half in the real world. Like I hear their words, but in my mind, I was like sitting in this lazy boy chair covered with IV stuff. And I was in like this large warehouse type of medical facility and I could see them. I could see the doctors in my mind as they were talking to me. So then when they were telling me, like, you're blind, And I was like, no, I'm not. I can see you right now.
Yeah.
What are you talking about? Like, I can see just fine. And so, kind of interesting. I don't know. You know, there is this thing, and they talk about it. It's called like phantom sight. But to me, it's not clear if it was really like a phantom sight or if I was still just kind of, you know, hallucinating or really high on whatever drugs they were giving me at the time, right?
Yeah.
While losing his sight was the most dramatic of his injuries, the rest of his body had been put through the ringer as well.
Puncture wounds on my shoulders and arms, upper arms. I had a puncture wound on my spine, my left leg. There were many claw marks. Some of those wounds were like 5 inches deep. You know, even after I survived the initial trauma, meaning maybe let's just say two
right.
days since the bear attack, and I'm still alive, right? They did the best they could to clear out all the bear saliva, the dirt, the debris, you know, all that stuff. But still, at that point, the risk of a lethal infection setting in was extremely high. And so, in fact, the doctors told my parents, like, hey, we don't know if you're the type of people that pray, but if you are, like, now's the time to pray. Cause basically, we just wait and see if, you know, infection kicks in. And if so, you know, pretty good chance it could be lethal.
What was the thing that hurt the most? Or was it all just like one cacophony of pain?
I mean, the wound cleaning definitely on my leg was not fun. Physical pain aside, and obviously I think the emotional pain was probably the most painful part of it all. The grief and loss of so many things. And plus just the trauma of it all. Like the mental effects of the trauma. But the hard thing about some of that grief and loss stuff is, unlike the physical pain, it doesn't really go away. Years later, you know, it's still grief, you know, not being out there skiing. You know, when the first snow falls or whatever. Trust me, I have so much to be grateful for. And so this is not me trying to play poor me. There's just some real reality to how things are different.
Both things can be true. You can be grateful for the life you have, but also be like, well, this other part is actually pretty shitty too.
Yeah, that's it. And I remember sitting in the hospital and kind of recognizing how close that death, you know, basically as a young person, like, I never really like thought.
You're 25,
you take
you're
life for
immortal.
Granted, right? You're 25. Yes. And then to recognize that, wow, okay, like I almost died without having real love in my life, without marriage, without being a father. And that really hit me hard for whatever reason. Again, kind of surprisingly, because it wasn't anything I had really thought about or put much time, energy into. But I recognized just how important that was to me, and kind of like grappling with what's life as a blind person going to be like? Is it going to be meaningful? When I really think about, like, well, what was I really scared of? I was scared that I was not going to be eligible for love and marriage, you know, that I was an ineligible bachelor, right? So I was afraid of being alone. I was afraid, again, of not being able to be a parent or kids. I was afraid of not being able to have work that was meaningful, like providing a simple sense of purpose. I was afraid of losing my autonomy. So, like, this idea that I think I had was I was going to probably live in an institution, or at the very least, that like the way I would engage with life for recreation or the community would be like going on field trips in 12 person passenger vans with other blind people. I mean, go to the zoo. And like just the very notion of any of that was just deeply terrifying. So, you know, conversely, like the segue, the natural segue to that is like, well, what are the things in life that are important to me that I can still do? Like, what
are those
various abilities, right? And it comes down to the question of like, what are the things in my life that would make a life worth living, you know?
Yeah.
And then making sure that you're doing those things. So whether it's going out to see live music, right? That's something I can still, playing music, getting out fishing, getting out camping, sitting around the fire with my friends and family, having a good time. Those are the things that, to me, you know, really make that life worth living.
And one positive that's come out of this whole ordeal is Dan reconnecting with his biological father. Dan's parents got divorced when he was a toddler, and he hadn't had a relationship with his biological father after that, until the bear.
So your brother called him?
I don't really know. I assume so. He would not have been high on the list or first on the list, just because he, had really been so out of the picture for so many years. You know, it was the type of thing where maybe we'd talk on Christmas or
right.
But he came when he learned what happened. Like, he did come to Alaska, and that was, again, one of those things. I think I was coming out of a different surgery, waking up and kind of aware that my biological dad was there.
Yeah.
And it was a good feeling. I was really glad he was there.
It, oh.
It felt very supportive, and just crazy life, right? Like, whatever circumstances that took us apart or whatever, that it was really this event that brought him back into my life in a more meaningful way. And we have a stronger relationship now. Also kind of cool just getting to know my dad, how much we have in common. I mean, how alike we are in so many different ways. Like, I didn't grow up with him. So it's not like, in terms of that nature-nurture conversation, it's completely just nature in this case, right?
Yeah. What kind of things do you have in common?
I mean, everything from literally we walked the same exact career path in many ways. I mean, he's a psychologist, I'm a social worker, but we both did community mental health with kids for many years. But also just his mannerisms. He's a very soft-spoken, very gentle person, very intelligent and thoughtful and kind, and just mannerisms that are very similar. And so getting to know him, I was kind of struck by how similar we are in many of those ways. Yeah.
Next time on Lived to Tell.
Amber is somebody that I noticed right away. I mean, the nightmares that were constant pretty much every time I fell asleep. And then the other thing that I was starting to have was pretty significant panic attacks.
See you in 1 week. I'm not going to re-edit the credits, so ignore me in like 20 seconds when I say 2 weeks. It's one. I will be back with the rest of Dan's story in 1 week.
This is Live to Tell. I'm Caitlin Van Maul. You can follow the show on Instagram and TikTok at Live to Tell Podcast. If you enjoy today's episode, please rate, review, and subscribe. It really helps the show. I'll see you in 2 weeks.